Welcome to one of the premier events of Silicon Valley Reads 2012, presented by the Santa Clara County Office of Education, the Santa Clara Library, the San Jose Public Library Foundation, and the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley. My name is Eleanor Yick, and I'm president of the League of Women Voters of Southwest Santa Clara Valley, one of the co-sponsors of this evening's panel discussion. Our league covers the cities of Los Gatos, Saratoga, Montesorino, and Campbell. The other league that's been heavily involved has been the San Jose Santa Clara branch, and we have their president here tonight, Gloria Chun-Hu, and they have been actively promoting it. Silicon Valley Reads 2012 is focused on the theme Muslim and American, two perspectives and two featured books. The Muslim Next Door, The Quran, The Media, and That Veil Thing by Sumbul Ali Karamali, and The Butterfly Mosque by G. Willow Wilson. Community events throughout Santa Clara County are exploring this topic and engaging the public in dialogue and sharing of perspective. Events continue through the end of April, and I encourage you to pick up a calendar of events in the lobby or back on the back table, or you can visit the website, www.siliconvalleyreads.org. It is my pleasure to introduce the three outstanding panelists we have here tonight to discuss the topic, Paranoid Politics, Islamophobia, McCarthyism, and the Yellow Peril. Let me tell you a little bit about each of them. Wajahat Ali, sitting in the middle there, is a playwright and an attorney. He is the author of the play, The Domestic Crusaders, one of the first major plays about Muslim Americans, published by McSweeney's in 2011, and the lead author of Fear Incorporated, The Roots of the Islamophobia Network in America, produced with the Center for American Progress. He is currently writing an HBO pilot with Dave Eggers about a Muslim American cop in the Bay Area. Congresswoman Mike Honda, right here on the left, has served in the House of Representatives for a decade. He grew up in California, but spent his early childhood in an internment camp in Colorado during World War II. His father served in the Military Intelligence Service, and the family returned to California in 1953 to become strawberry sharecroppers in San Jose's Blossom Valley. Mike served in the Peace Corps in El Salvador before becoming a teacher and a principal. He was elected to the San Jose Unified School Board, the California State Assembly, and the Santa Clara County Board of Supervisors before his election to the U.S. Congress. And Dr. Larry Gersten, on the right, who will be our moderator this evening, as well as a panel member, is Professor Emeritus of Political Science at San Jose State University. He is the author of half a dozen books, including his newest book, Not So Golden After All, The Rise and Fall of California. He is the political analyst at NBC 11, and a frequent speaker and media spokesperson on current political trends and issues. Please join me in welcoming our panel.
Let's go. Well, we've got Islamophobia, McCarthyism, and the Yellow Peril. But we all know that we could talk about discrimination and prejudice in virtually all shapes and sizes. It goes well beyond any of these. And some of these terms really are part of our everyday lives, and we don't even think about it when somebody welches on a bet. When someone is called an Indian giver. When someone Jews somebody down. People we know, all the time use these phrases. Good people who don't even think about what the terms mean. It's part of their vocabulary, part of their vernacular. And that is what has seeded itself in American society. So we're going to focus tonight on Asians, the Yellow Peril, Jews, the McCarthy period, and Islamophobia. We all know what's going on these days, or maybe we don't. But bearing in mind, I think that just about everybody in American society, one way or another, has been impacted by or touched someone else who has felt some of these terrible kinds of things. So I would like to begin by asking my colleagues tonight, what is it? What is it that leads people in your minds, from your experience, to be prejudiced about others because of their skin, their religion, their clan, their gender, whatever it might be? Thoughts?
To add to your phrase, and speaking up for the Asians, the phrase chink in the armor has been just recently used too.
Yep.
Yeah.
There you go.
So, and I think you're right. There's a lot of things that we say because we learned it in context of other things, and so we use it. And we use it when the context seems to be there again. But in terms of paranoia, for me, it's like I may be paranoid, but that doesn't mean that they're not out to get me, you know. Is sometimes paranoia is a survival mechanism, you know. So, I think all of us have had that experience and that what I call the sixth sense. When you walk into a social situation or something like that, you know that perhaps you're not supposed to be there. So I think the subject matter tonight is going to be important and it's going to be interesting. And in terms of yellow peril or the kinds of things that government's doing, over the decades, the players are different, but the script is the same. And so I think that this is what we have to be vigilant about and be ready to address it.
Well, as a member of the stealth jihadists, allow me to offer my opinion. I'm just kidding, by the way. That is a joke. Because I know this is on Commonwealth. I don't want anyone to misquote me. Congressman Honda made a good point. This story is a remake. It keeps being produced decade after decade. And it's just that the antagonist seems to change. So in the past, it was the Japanese Americans, it was Jews, it was African Americans in 2004, and still today it's gays and lesbians. And now it seems to be the Muslims and or the Arabs. But it seems to be that the two roots of this evil of, if you could say, fear-mongering and hysteria, hate-mongering, seems to be ignorance, number one, and number two, misinformation. Ignorance, people just don't know. And number two, misinformation, what they do know is usually negative stereotypes or bad information. And I think when ignorance and misinformation are exploited, as they generally are in all of these eras, during times especially of fear and paranoia, it generally breeds what I say is hostility, and it can lead to bigotry and hate. Specifically, I think this disease can infect anyone. No one really is immune to it. And I think you are immune if you make a deliberate, conscious decision to rise above it, to inoculate yourself with education and proper information. But there is, as Congressman Hondo was saying, this fight-flight system that we have as human beings, right? We want to feel safe. We want to feel protected. They're out to get us. And that sometimes does hinder our common sense or our better nature. And I think what happens is, in this fight-flight system, we create an other. We create the enemy. And it's this type of language and behavior of otherization that dehumanizes our fellow neighbor and our fellow man and our fellow citizen. And it makes it easier for us as a nation to strip away their rights, their dignity, and their freedoms. There's a great quotation, I'll end it on this, from journalist H.L. Mencken, that said, people would rather feel safe than be free. People would rather feel safe than be free. And it seems that the illusion of safety, because sometimes all it is an illusion, the illusion of safety comes at the expense of the freedoms of the marginalized, of the minority, of the quote-unquote other.
Do either of you think that this prejudice marked by fear and ignorance is more pronounced in some parts of the world than others? Or is the United States no different, unique? How do we account for this in a global context as well as the context here?
I go first again?
Yeah. Flip a coin.
No, a couple of years ago, the government of France was going through this exercise of getting rid of all these symbols of religions. You know, you couldn't wear a crucifix. You couldn't wear a yarmulke, right? Yarmulke. Or you couldn't wear a turban or anything that reflected your religious upbringing. And it's not you're imposing it on. Kids don't impose it upon each other, but they were getting rid of it as a matter of political decisions. And I wrote a letter to them and saying, we learned democracy and liberty from France, and how is it that you can go backwards on freedom of religion and freedom of expression? And I guess I was summarily told mind your own business, But it's happened in France, and I think it happens all around the world in different formats. But I wonder what the motivation is. Is it fear? Is it control? Is it lack of? Is it fear of losing control? It's interesting. But I think we're probably the country that really does it the best.
Or the worst.
But it occurs over in McCarthyism, throwing under God in the Pledge of Allegiance, Peter King and his seeking the radicalization of Muslims rather than radicalization of, people in this country. It's all disconcerting, and I just wonder. I keep wondering. When are we going to learn?
Any differences?
It's a good question. I think the roots of it again are ignorance, misinformation. I want to add power in there.
Mm-hmm.
People seeking power, or people who think they're being dispossessed of power. And I'll explain that in a moment. Specifically, I think no one is immune to this, whether you come from a quote-unquote multicultural background or from a monocultural background. I'll explain what I mean by that in a second. For example, we look at Europe right now. The rage is all about multiculturalism and the failure of multiculturalism. I mean, the Chancellor Merkel of Germany pretty much has said that multiculturalism has failed in Germany. Prime Minister Cameron of Britain had said the same thing. And what he's mentioned in France and Belgium and Switzerland and Italy and Spain, what we're seeing is a resurgence of Islamophobia and specifically anti-immigrant sentiment that is really sweeping the discourse. And especially in France, you have people like Le Pen who are writing their political party based on this fear, quite deliberately, to get votes. And it seems to be working to some extent. We see that happening also in the United States right now. There are several 2012 Republican, primarily presidential candidates, who are getting tremendous votes and money based off of fear and fear of the other, specifically fear of the quote-unquote stealth jihadist or fear of Sharia taking over, the anti-Sharia legislation that we could talk about that has been introduced in 24 states. But at the same time, some people want to blame multiculturalism and say, see, a multicultural society fails, it can't work, it breeds this type of prejudice. Well, we're living in the United States of America, which, as we just heard, has the best and the worst. But we still survive. We still live. Here we are at the JCC, a Muslim sitting at the JCC. They gave me water. Everyone's been very nice to me. I hope it's the same. Sitting next to an Asian American, sitting next to a Jewish American. And this is a nice little microcosm of the messy, vibrant world of America, a multicultural society where we collide on a daily basis. It is chaotic. It is messy, yet it still works. Right. So perhaps multiculturalism is messy, but it's not a failure. Let's talk about real quick some societies where it's predominantly, if you will, monocultural from at least a racial standpoint. I just came back from Pakistan, where most of the people are the same color. Okay. That being said, right now in 2012, there are tremendous divisions and the same type of fear and rhetoric and paranoia that people are deliberately exploiting for the sake of their political agenda based on tribalism, language differences, and religious differences, even though everyone looks exactly the same, primarily. So we see this as a human condition, and I see these roots manifesting themselves globally and historically. And there is something about power, people who feel like they're losing power. I'll just end it on this note. Southern Poverty Law Center just recorded that in 2012, it is the highest amount of hate groups have been recorded in America, more than 1,000. They have detailed the causes, the roots of the rise. The main cause, as they say, is number one, the economy. The depressed economic situation increases panic and fear and unrest. Number two, changing racial dynamics in America. Number three, President Obama. And number four, what we see is the three exponential rises are in nativist anti-immigrant groups, white supremacist groups, and anti-government groups. And the theme seems to be the following. This is no longer my country. My country is being taken away from me. I woke up and I saw a country that I no longer recognize. They are taking it away from me. Who is they? The other. So I just want to mention those points.
Yeah, I think the economy is something we cannot emphasize enough. Because you look around and you're in an unstable environment, you're losing your home or you know somebody else is, you've lost your job, you're looking to find another one, and now these damn Chinese are coming in. They're taking our jobs. Or the Mexicans are coming in. They're taking our jobs. Mind you, nobody's going to go out there and pick fruit at $8 an hour. Okay? But it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. They're taking our jobs. And that you put that into with the whole idea that the country is changing. In California, we already know that we no longer have a, quote, white majority. In the schools, 60% non-white. And yet, even though in our schools we have so many different languages, LA Unified School District, 100 different languages or more, in the same school district, you know, thanks to earlier propositions in this state, we give them one year to learn English. 1 year. Now, anybody who studies linguistics knows it takes 5 to 7 years. 1 year to learn English, and after that, they are, quote, mainstreamed. Guess what happens to all these people who are mainstreamed? They drop out, right? And then they're part of the have-nots in our society, disproportionately at that. So, and then that's a threat. That's a threat. So the idea of a threat to the status quo, the threat to what we've known, you know, that kind of a change is very hard on people. Rather than embracing change for what some people call diversity and all that it augurs, we run from it. We run from it. I'm wondering to what extent either of you think, and this is very interesting because we have one person, he's going to hate me for saying this, who's part of the establishment. I'll never get away with that again. We have another person who I would say is somewhat outside the establishment in terms of the way you look at things.
He doesn't make a living yet.
Well played.
So with the two of you coming in that respect at least, you know, from different, let's call it vantage points, what role do you think governments have in promoting political paranoia? And stirring the pot, in fomenting fear, or are they getting to a point, whether we want to talk about the U.S. national government or state government or any other, where they are trying to help us overcome it?
Well, politicians are not a great example of a model of, you know, accepting things and trying to work things out. You know, we have people, and they seem to attract the most attention, the ones that are the furthest, the most extreme. And I'll say his name, you know, Peter King is outrageous. And but he thrives on it, and the media keeps, you know, reinforcing his behavior. And so I think the media has a responsibility. Politicians have a responsibility.
Comes down to the media. Okay.
Yeah. And let me quote, you know, remember Randolph Hearst. He said, it is my job to mold public opinion. And he did. He made sure that everybody understood that Chinese are not to be trusted, that they can never be Christians. They should not mix with the white population. They should not be in the same schools or the same classroom with our young daughters. And so that created, and they're, you don't know how old they are because, you know, they could be 15 and be in a classroom with third graders. And so people start to ingest this poison, and pretty soon they start to even believe it. And then the politician starts passing laws and, you know, ordinances against the community. When at first they brought them in to do hard labor, and then when their labor was not needed anymore, they vilified them and tried to get rid of them. And then they had the 1882 Chinese Exclusion Act, which right now the Asian American legislators in Congress were trying to get Congress to understand that that was not necessary and that we would look for an apology and a regret for passing that law. One thing about this country, we can do that now and make that effort to reteach something that has gone awry in the past. But politicians, policymakers, sometimes they'll do it at the expense of other people in order for them to get elected or reelected. That's insane. And you know, that's why I always say, tell students, I didn't take a pledge, an oath of office to the government. It was to the Constitution. And the Constitution is the contract. And I try to live by that and understand the principles and measure everything against that. And then against some of the good common sense my mother taught me.
There have been examples, by the way, before you answer this for a second, there have been examples where, you know, once in a while the government gets it right. For example, belatedly apologizing to Japanese Americans for internment, giving them whatever, $25,000 a person, which, of course, in no way makes up for the years they spent incarcerated. But the apology came, apologizing to the African-American community for slavery, things like that. But it just seems to take so long. It seems to take so long, and so much of the damage seems to be done. And you kind of wonder, is it something about our government where we cannot admit fault, where we sort of have to go past it and get over it because we don't want to be reminded of it, I wonder.
Well, it's like you said, it's about ignorance and not being taught. In Japan, they have not taught their young people what they've done in China.
So or Korea.
Or Korea, right? And so, you know, they're ignorant about it, and they wonder, what the hell's wrong with Mike Honda, you know? He's trying to get the Japanese government to apologize to the comfort women as victims. And so, you know, the ignorance and not teaching our young people the truth, the facts, you know, we create a whole generation of ignorant citizens.
But are we not responsible for it? Let me just push this one minute more. For example, everybody, you know, who can read understands what the Turks did to the Armenians. You know, and yet everybody puts their heads in the sand over the deal. We don't want to go there. You know, we don't want to go there because, you know, it's gonna hurt relations with this or that. Where's principle come in? You know, does it ever trump over political reality?
Well, one, you have to make sure that the information you got is accurate. I mean, some people will write stuff to present their position. Like when Wolfowitz wrote Pax Americana, he said, you know, we're going to be the only superpower. We ought to take advantage of it. If that's not the epitome of bullyism, I don't know what is. You know, so it depends who's writing, and then you got to judge that because... You know, when people say Columbus discovered America, you got to ask who wrote that history book. Yeah. You know, was it a Native American? There's nothing against Italians. It's just that, you know, in fact, Columbus was an Italian, but he outsourced himself to Spain.
Spain. Yeah. That might have been the earliest example of outsourcing, actually. Yeah. You're on the outside looking in.
Right.
You know, do you see government having some sort of a stirring the pot role here, more than a role that is designed to really make up for to take a leadership role.
Sure. You know, speaking of principles, you question about principles. I think if principles can be translated into votes or donations, then yes, they will trump in the political landscape. Speaking about governments and political leaders, sorry, Congressman Honda.
Don't apologize.
And so speaking about specifically about governments and the role of politicians, I do believe as an outsider that they have a role because they occupy a privileged position, a privileged place. There are elected representatives, furthermore, and they help shape and dictate policy. And furthermore, they should represent our country's current values or our country's enduring values. Now, I'm going to say something which I'll probably never say again, but there is something that George W. Bush did right. And let me tell you, as an example, President George W. Bush, let me give you an example. After the 9/11 tragedy, he set a good leadership example in this regards. He made it a point twice in national addresses to say that Islam is not the enemy. And furthermore, he said that we are at war with terrorists, not Islam, and that Muslim Americans are fellow citizens. That was right. A principled, good leadership.
That's right.
And you should applaud. That was good. Now, of course, his policies were misguided and kind of helped engender a lot of problems, but that rhetoric was important. That rhetoric by a political leader, not just any leader, the commander-in-chief. Now, look at some of the rhetoric that is being employed by those running for presidential office in 2012. Examples I already gave are Newt Gingrich. Before she was in the race, Michelle Bachmann. There was also the ex-CEO of Godfather Pizza. He was in there. Rick Santorum and others. Even elected officials such as Alan West from Florida, who has quite openly said Islam is the enemy. Specifically, it seems that politicians who have this space have exploited fear for the sake of votes. I'll give you a quick example. Midterm elections 2010. Does anyone remember the quote-unquote Ground Zero Mosque controversy?
Of course.
Everyone remembers that? Okay. A non-issue that became a local issue that transformed into a national issue that became an international issue, which still continues to threaten our national security today. We can talk about it later. It's a community center that was modeled after the JCC in New York with advice from the JCC that is not a mosque nor at Ground Zero. But it became an issue magically overnight in the summer right before midterm elections, and people benefited from it, such as Representative Renee Elmers, who ran off that as a talking point. So what we see is a spike in Islamophobia and even an anti-Arab sentiment in tune with pivotal political moments in our history. And I think also, as an outsider looking in, there is a top-down approach where our government or our political leaders kind of give talking points that are then mainstreamed by the media. I'll give a quick example. In 1979, who was the enemy? Iran, right? Islamic Revolution of Iran. It was a threat. It was the other. We saw the Iron Sheikh in the WWF, right, kind of seeped into our political cultural consciousness. In the 80s, the enemies or the threat was Libya, was Iran, was Iraq, was Palestine, and we look at 80s Hollywood movies. Delta Force, Iron Eagle, Not Without My Daughter, True Lies, even Aladdin, yes, Aladdin, Down Out in Beverly Hills. So we see it, and we see it kind of seep into our consciousness. Even in the 80s, look, the Mujahideen were once good guys. So good that Sylvester Stallone in Rambo 3 went to help them, right? He went to Afghanistan to help them. Now, they are the Taliban and our enemies. Just the reframing of language. And again, that was synonymous with the language that our political leaders were using. These are our good guys. These are our friends. These are freedom fighters. And so now in the post 9/11, it has become Islam is the enemy. And I think there's a shift here where there are some elected officials like Peter King, Alan West, Sue Myrick, who is retiring, I believe, Renee Elmers, Newt Gingrich, and others who are deliberately exploiting this current fear and bigotry and hostility for the sake of votes. And then there are others who have decided that enough is enough and they're not going to steer their country or their party that way. And just for the Republicans in the audience, there is good hope there because there are some Republicans, such as the governor of New Jersey, Governor Chris Christie, who said that this anti-Sharia legislation is crazy and it's nonsense. The reason why they attacked Governor Christie is because he nominated an American Muslim, Sohail Muhammad, to be a district judge. And people said his nomination, which was based on the qualifications of Sohail Muhammad, was an example that Governor Christie was succumbing to radical Islam. He heard that and he said, this is crazy, enough is enough. Ron Paul is another person who stood up. We also see Colin Powell, who gave a very brave speech and very brave talk to Meet the Press in 2008, and publicly asked, so what if President Obama was a Muslim? What's wrong with that? He isn't a Muslim, by the way. I can tell you, as a Muslim, he's not a Muslim. And if he is a Muslim, he's the worst Muslim of all time because he drinks alcohol openly and he commits the worst sin. He eats pork. So I just want to give you that example that as an outsider looking in, I think political representatives and politicians and governments have a very influential role. And we've seen the top-down approach that when they set the rhetoric, when they set the policy, it seems to seep into our collective consciousness and it affects our discourse. So they need to be more responsible. Definitely.
We know the phrase, what is it, the enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Right.
And I think we never saw any better example of that than when the Mujahideen were fighting the Soviet Union.
Right.
Because then they were wonderful. We armed them. We helped them. Right. They were our buds. Okay? And then, of course, fast forward 20 years, 25 years, we get ourselves in this mess in Afghanistan, and suddenly they're our enemy. The same people, you know, the same group. You know, it's sort of an interesting phenomenon. I do want to add one thing about some of these extremists in office. Of all the people to tar with that, Mike Honda is the last one. If anybody knows Congressman Honda, for crying out loud, we know. Yes, I mean. Yeah. We're really putting him in company with an odd group here, and we'll take him out of that real fast. But if you look at the election of 2010, when you had a lot of this bizarre behavior come up, I think it came up for two reasons. Number one, because we were a lot closer to the whole question of terrorism two years ago than we are now. I think people are beginning to slowly but surely put it in perspective. But the other reason was the phenomenon of American politics. Opposite year elections are low turnout elections. So we had very low turnout in 2010. All the Democrats got happy and stayed at home. And that's just a phenomenon. You know, Democrats aren't good at being consistent about that stuff. And the Republicans, particularly the Tea Party types, you know, who in many respects represent that very threatened segment of society we were just talking about. You know, the ones who feel like their country's been taken away from them. The ones who are losing what they've got. The middle class is literally being pulled out from under their legs. And they're wobbly because of that. They came out in very large numbers, and so we had a skewed turnout. And with that, of course, we had a Congress that was taken over, not just by the Republicans, but the Tea Party element being very, very explosive, 80, 85 people there. So I think that probably exacerbated the problem. Would you say that, Mike?
Yeah. I was hoping that this political analyst Cook, he was saying that the Democrats can only lose 63 seats. I thought, what is it he's smoking? You know, how can we lose 63? And he hit it right on the nose. And the Republicans lost 20. So, you know, they have an 83 member Tea Party there. But I was just thinking about your comments about the movies and everything. I thought, oh yeah, I know those movies. I saw those movies. I wasn't even that sensitive about it. And it dawned upon me, I'll look at Asian stuff and I'll say, man, that is crass. You know, they're really stepping over the line. So I think the sensitivity thing is really based upon, you know, our own experiences and our own perceptions. And I think that we need to, you know, heighten our awareness and cross over and understand, you know, how is this going to affect other people? It's this whole movement across this country, even comprehensive immigration reform has taken the same, you know, is on the same train as all this anti-Muslim and everything else. Like, it's anti-everybody. It's trying to separate folks from the mainstream. And I think that we really have to stop it. One of the things that we're doing right now as party members is that in the last election, there was a couple of Democrats who was running for Senate, and they used the Asian thing as, you know, and saying, you know, my opponent loves China, and, you know, therefore they're going to do everything for China. And it was crass. I mean, it was so obvious to us, but not obvious to a lot of people. So, you know, the Asian American legislators, we got together, we told our own leadership, we're not going to put up with this from our own party. If it happens, we're going to speak up to it. And our leadership says, we agree with you. And so we need to speak up in every possible opportunities. doesn't matter which party you belong to, you know. When you're wrong, you're wrong. And, you know, the Japanese-American experience, when they studied the internment, the commission came back with a report saying that they came with three conclusions. The reasons why we were put in camp, it was racial prejudice, war hysteria, and a failure of political leadership. And that's going to be key, I think, in this country. But these politicians are here because the people voted them in. And so I think there's a responsibility of citizens to be aware what the heck their members are doing and whether they're doing things in the best interest of the country and the best interest of themselves.
I'm going to get to that citizen idea in just a second, but I do think it's important to add one caveat that maybe has been overlooked. We tend sometimes to simplify this whole story of paranoia in terms of the white majority, you know, looking down at Asians or Latinos or whatever. Sadly, it actually could be minorities looking at minorities, you know. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I discovered as I finished my last book, Not So Golden After All, The Rise and Fall of California, soon at bookstores near you. But seriously, African Americans upset with Koreans as they come into their neighborhood and set up shop in stores. Indians going at it with Chinese because they both have a good deal of business acumen, and so they get mad at each other. So this thing we call paranoia and prejudice, it isn't just, you know, the majority,
right,
whatever they are, picking on that minority, the minority du jour. You know, it's minorities also picking on each other, and I think some of that has to do with that economic ladder. You know, everybody feeling that if they're not on the bottom rung, they're getting close to it. And this is a phenomenon of human nature, I think, that goes well beyond one race or another. We've talked about the fact that we can't count on government to, for this, I'll use the phrase trickle down, not in an economic context, to trickle down common sense and you know, understanding. What about the schools? What about the education process? Is that an opportunity here that we have not seized?
Definitely. I think so. I mean, I'll give you an example. The first time I really learned about Judaism was in my school when they had a citizen from one of the neighborhoods come in and give us an hour discussion about Jews in America. And they gave us a dreidel at the end of the day, and we did dreidel wars. And I thought that was the most amazing thing of all time, to have dreidels. But the point I'm trying to say is education system, specifically, I remember they also have this vivid memory in sixth grade where we had world history. And we talked about Romans, we talked about the Greeks, and then we did a fast forward and got to the Renaissance. And then we did a fast forward, then we got to Enlightenment, and then we did a fast forward and we got to U.S. history. And I remember, like, I saw for the first time Islamic civilization and Muslim history there. I'm like, hey, can we talk about this? And then, like, it's not on the syllabus. And education and the educational system, I think, is a great place where people, especially students who have these fresh, ripe, curious minds, can be exposed to a narrative that is healthy and complex and more representative of reality. One where I think, especially in the United States, especially in California, look at like the diversity in this room, where you're being taught not that, you know, quote unquote, Islam is the enemy and every Muslim is a stealth jihadist, but you can be taught that, hey, your doctor who helped save your father's life, that's a Muslim. Or the taxi cab driver whom you rely upon, that's a Muslim. Or the teacher, here, I'm the teacher of this class, I wear hijab, let me tell you why. And it's a great place where we literally send our children so they can be exposed to new ideas, to new narratives. But the problem happens to be, especially when it comes to the educational system with Islam right now, is again, 62% of Americans say they don't know a Muslim. 62%. Even though Muslims have been here for 300 years, they say a third of the slave trade that was forcibly brought here against their will was Muslims. And in the Olympics, was 97 Olympics? 98 Olympics. Which one was it? Where Muhammad Ali was chosen as a representative of the United States to hold the torch.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people forget that he is a Muslim American. But 62% say they don't know a Muslim. And even in the educational system, when you go there, no one's being taught about Islamic history or American Muslim contribution to American society. And so I think there has been a failure of our education system, as a person who has gone through the education system, where we haven't been taught not only about Muslim Americans, but also Islam in an appropriate way. And that means not giving it a politically correct sheen or gloss, you know, just talk about it in a nice, complex, honest, academic fashion. And the vacuum, I could tell you from my experience, was filled by me. I was the token Muslim. I was the token, like they said, Wajahat, there's a war in Iraq, why don't you talk? Wajahat, Islam, give a speech. Prophet Muhammad, Wajahat, or it was Wajahat, or, you know, Central Asia, Waj, step up. So in elementary school and in high school and even in college, University of California, Berkeley, I and others like me were the tokens who had to step up and speak about our people because there was such a dearth and vacuum in the educational system and its lack of material. So much so that in 2002 at UC Berkeley, in my second semester, there were no classes on Islam, so me and two other students had to step up and set up our own decal class that we taught to 55 students about Islam. And so as a person who is a product of the American education system, who's been very privileged and gone to excellent schools, I've noticed this deficit of knowledge and information. And I really do think that it would be more valuable to not only have situations like this that we have, the Silicon Valley Reads, hopefully that could get translated into elementary school and in high school. And pardon me if I spoke too long.
No, you did good.
Mike?
I'm a classroom teacher, and I guess I'm pretty critical about our educational system because we don't set things up for dialogue like tonight. This is a great way to learn about each other and about other perceptions and sensitivities. Or it's a way to find out that, oh, they have the same experience that I had, so I'm not crazy either. Right. You know, so being the only one growing up in Chicago, you know, they didn't say, oh, Mike, you're Japanese-American. Tell us about Japan. It's, oh, there's a Jap kid. Go beat his ass, you know. And right after the war, so, you know, there was a lot of, you know, antagonism. And so, you know, I oppressed myself, you know. There's two kinds of oppression, what people do to you and what you do to yourself. And a lot of times, I was my own worst enemy because I practiced this, what I call, internal oppression that kept me from being fully who I should be. And people would say, oh, he's just shy, you know. No, I was oppressing myself and keeping myself from being fully expressive about how I felt. And as a result, you know, I was... In Spanish, we call them tartamudas, you know. Somebody keeps stuttering and can't come out with a good, long, cogent sentence and express yourself properly. It was a long journey for me. And I suspect there's a lot of young people that are the same way, have experienced this because of being different or coming from a different background. And so the educational system not only is systemic, but it's also individual youngsters that, you know, impacts the full potential of an individual solely because of who they think they are or what people think of them. Mm. And so, and it's very unhealthy.
Mm. We'll come back, but we've got some questions. Thank you all. And let's see if we can get to a couple of them. Here's the first one. Is it the human condition to be so fearful of others who are different and to assume the worst? Or is it something about the last century or America that makes us paranoid?
Am I going?
We'll start with the easy ones.
What's that?
Go ahead. I said we'll start with the easy ones.
Oh, okay, yeah, a very easy question. Thank you. I think we've discussed the first aspect, and I'm going to go back to the answer that I think no one is immune to succumbing to fear and hysteria. Again, something about the human condition, quite literally, is the fight-flight response, where it's about self-protection, right? Evolution. We have to survive. And if someone is telling us that this person, this individual, this class of people is your enemy out to get you, your immediate response, if you don't know any better, is fear, defense. keep myself protected from them. A good inoculation against that is, again, education. That might sound simplistic, but it seems to be, according to all the research and data, the best mechanism to counteract that. To educate yourself, to inoculate yourself against fear and bigotry and prejudice and stereotypes and scapegoating by knowing better, by knowing the other, by realizing the yellow peril is not the yellow peril, but is an elected congressman, Congressman Honda, who speaks eloquently and fights for the rights and dignities of all people, of all citizens, right? To know that your teacher, just because she wears the hijab, the headscarf, is not an al-Qaeda trainer or recruit, but quite literally happens to be both American and Muslim without discord, without any sort of conflict in those values, and who comes out every day to teach your children. And I think there's something about education and common sense and I think a human temperance towards doing good, to answer that question. I think there's something within the human condition, and also I would like to say in the American condition, something within our spiritual and cultural DNA that makes us optimistic and makes us realize that, you know what, we cannot indulge in stereotyping in knee-jerk reactionary politics. And when we do, we feel a sense of shame. So when we look back now on McCarthyism, when we look back now on Yellow Peril, we teach our children this was a moment that our country succumbed to paranoia and fear. This does not represent our values. This represents our darkest nature, our darkest aspect. But we eventually rose above it. And specifically about America, I think there is a reset button in American history. And we have something within us in this country where we are allowed to refine our moral compass that takes us forward out of these moments of fear and paranoia and prejudice so that we can look back and say, you know, the McCarthyites and others are now the villains of our children's history books. And so I think it's you know, to answer it succinctly, which I did not, but to conclude on it succinctly, I think it's a reflection of the human condition. We are creatures of tremendous generosity, selflessness. You know, we can be great neighbors. Look at America, for example, Statue of Liberty, holding that torch, lighting the way for the world's outcasts, right? Come to our shores. And then when you come to your shores, you know, the streets of America, as we know, aren't paved with gold, they're paved with blood. But then eventually that blood dries up and we look back and say, you know what, we took a beating, but we made it. And it's up to the citizens now to reflect on our better nature, our better values, to say, you know, just because the Japanese went through it, just because the African Americans went through it, just because the Arabs and the Muslims are going through it, just because the Jews are going through it, we're going to make sure as a community that no one else has to go through it again. I hope I answered that question.
And yet, the U.S. Supreme Court has just agreed to accept a case from Texas, in which the whole idea of affirmative action, which has been watered down considerably since the concept was first brought forward, is in all likelihood going to be stripped altogether if people's reading of the court is correct, and people are pretty good at reading those tea leaves. So when we redefine that compass, you know, sometimes it goes back in the direction that some of us hoped we would be leaving. I think that's what makes the fight one that goes on every day. You know, it's not one that any of us can take for granted, my editorial. Here's one. Has the U.S. We'll talk about another group here for a second. Has the U.S. ever apologized to the Native Americans? If not, don't you think they deserve our support before any other group? It's an interesting question since they are, quote, sovereign nations, unquote, at least those who live in reservations, and the Department of Justice has a heck of a time trying to figure out when and when they should not even get involved with criminal issues. Mike, I don't mean to make you responsible for all the lawmaking in the country, but can you shed some light on this?
I asked that the same question once, and I think the answer was, there was an attempt to apologize, but I'm not sure that the apology came with any overt action to work with Indian country as a sovereign nation. We've ignored them, and we know that the conditions on in Indian country is as if you went to worse than a third world country in a lot of respects, and so. We espouse sovereignty. We say that, you know, they are a sovereign nation, but we don't praxis, we don't acknowledge their sovereignty. We try to impose ourselves upon that sovereignty. The issue of gaming is one good example where they found a way to have income, and so everybody else is trying to get into the act and trying to see if they get a piece of the action. Because the state of California had certain kinds of laws that they imposed in trying to limit their activities or to get involved in this. The federal government has certain kinds of rules and regulations that manages our behavior, but it's not what I would call a real acknowledgement of that term sovereignty, as you know, that we're not treating them as a sovereign nation. And we turn a deaf ear and a blind eye to that, and we just I think it's exposure too. But it's hard to explain. I went through the different reservations and seeing the health clinics not being well, doesn't have the personnel, seeing the impact of alcoholism and drugs and everything else like that, where we know the dynamics of how it happened, and we've taken away the roots that they used to depend upon in order to maintain their own dignity and their own sense of self, and we've taken their whole structure of selfness away, and we have a lot of work to do with the Indian country.
Yeah. Now we turn to a moment that is very personal, I suspect, for many of you. Are our airport security measures the result of paranoia or the result of reality? A buzz in the crowd.
I think it's both. There's an attempt to try to make people safe. But what I've learned is that airports are either owned by the city or by airlines, and we can't get a consistent cooperation out of any of them in terms of trying to apply technology that we know would work, that we could move people through without putting them through a lot of changes. We're not willing to spend the money, and we're not willing to apply the technologies that we know will check people out, secure their privacy, and know, you know, whether there's good guys and bad guys going through. We're not doing that. I think that we can set ourselves up for an attack that may not be as overt and as tragic as the attack on the Twin Towers. It would be an attack that would create a disruption, an attack of mass disruption that could disrupt this economy in this country. If you took a bunch of when this first started, I put together a Blue Ribbon Task Force on airport security. In fact, you helped us. See, I'm getting it now, the line of questioning. And we had all the high-tech folks sit down, including a constitutional attorney. And they said, why do we need a constitutional attorney? I said, because technology is agnostic. I said, okay, I'll accept that, but people are not. People are the ones that, you know, employ the technology, so I think that having a constitutional attorney as part of the team was a good idea. And a couple weeks into it, they said it was a good idea. And we had a plan for airport security using cyber systems and all the current technology at that time. And we wrote it up, and we presented it to the Secretary of Transportation. Yeah. And I think that we're missing the boat. And it's going to take – why is it that it takes a tragedy for us to just, you know, get our act together? And I think part of it is people don't want to spend the money, the time, and they're just lazy.
And missing the boat in airport security is no easy thing.
Do you want to add to
it? Can I just ask a funny story? I just came back from an overseas trip in the morning today. Yesterday I was in JFK Airport going through customs. And I was going through customs and they said, you have to go to the room. And I'm like, what room? And the guy's like, the room at the back. I'm like, what room in the back? And the guy, I swear to God, you've never been to the room in the back? And I said, no, man, and no one's ever asked me to go to the room in the back. And he goes, okay, I got to take you to the room in the back. So they took me to the room in the back, where it was me and other ethnic undesirables sitting in a room looking confused. And at the Department of Homeland Security symbol was right there. It was just this big, inefficient, like murky gray room with a really bad outdated technology, too. And they just said, sit here. I'm like, I sat. And I'm like, I have a connecting flight. They're like, okay, good, just wait. So I waited a half hour. They took my passport, and all of a sudden, they're like, all right, you're good. I'm like, what do you mean? You're good to go. I'm like, anything else? I'm like, nope. You want to ask me any questions? They're like, nope. They're like, why am I here? They're like, it just happens. So then I went, and I was just thinking about it. I'm like, I was sent by the U.S. Embassy to visit overseas. In the overseas countries, I'm treated well. I come back to the United States, JFK, and they ask me, look on the screen, they say, go to a room, which was fine, you know. So I think it's a reflection of a paranoid reality. And I think, again, it goes back to my comment that people would rather feel safe than be free, even though they undergo measures that give us the illusion of safety. And I think what we found right now with the TSA is that racial profiling, what they've discovered, is ineffective. All right? So the key thing is effective. Well, first of all, if you engage in racial profiling, is it at least effective in trampling on other people's rights? Well, it's proven that it's not. Specifically with the TSA measure, there are some problems because they seem to be focusing on the wrong things. I'll end on a quick example where they've done tests of the TSA security measures, and they put a fake bomb in there, okay, going through the security, and they put a water bottle. They got the water bottle. They missed the fake bomb. Okay, so we're protected against water. This is good to know. So again, I'm all for effective security measures that at the same time promote our security and promote our safety, but also promote our liberties. I don't think they're mutually exclusive.
And I will add to that that I think it's not just better technology and training. It's also common sense. Common sense. And I will share with you a story that you will not believe. A few months ago, the Dalai Lama was in town. Okay, you know, the Dalai Lama, like a lot of other people who are notables, kind of stands out. Okay? You could tell who the Dalai Lama is. Okay? And
looks like me.
Yeah. You know, only he's got fancier clothing. So we're at the airport, my wife and I, about to go someplace. The Dalai Lama's right ahead of us, with his great big bodyguard, you know, and they pull the two aside to search the Dalai Lama. What, they think he's got an Uzi under there or something? I mean, I almost spoke, but then I would have been in the gray room. So I did not. But I could not get over this. This is common sense. Do you read a newspaper? Do you watch television? Do you do something besides, you know, watch cop shows? I couldn't get over it. This common sense sometimes goes a long way.
Well, the criteria that a lot of TSA uses is if they have clothes that look like you could hide a bomb.
Yeah.
You know, they're not looking at the person. They're looking at the clothing. Sikhs go through this all the time. They're wearing the turbans. And some of them go in and out all the time as entrepreneurs, businessmen. They create jobs, pay taxes. And every time they come through, they got to be pulled aside. And it gets boring after a while. And then it gets, you know, it's really, you know, it makes people angry. And so, you know, they're not using their common sense. So I think we really have to grow up in this country. Because certain people, it happens to them consistently all the time. You know.
Let's get to maybe a little bit heavier question. Please discuss the President signing the National Defense Authorization Act that negates the writ of habeas corpus to suspected terrorists. And the Supreme Court decision yesterday, someone's reading the newspaper, allow the strip search of people without probable cause. Who wants to go first?
I'll do that. I mean, there's a couple of things. One, the National Defense Authority Act that was signed, that's the piece that we have to go back and take out and surgically remove. I think that President Obama said something like, but I'm not going to apply this to U.S. citizens. Okay. Still, there's a constitutional question there, I think. Historically, there's still a law on the books that allows a president to detain, to jail, to deport a person solely because they don't agree with what they said or they don't like what they wrote. And it's a law that was passed in 1789. It's called the Alien Sedition Act of 1789. I've got a bill that's going to attempt to get rid of it. And I had a debate with the Attorney General Holder. And he says, it's going to be difficult, Michael. You could try it, but it's going to be difficult because the president has that authority in a time of war, in declaration of war. I said, we're moving towards asymmetric conflicts. And this is a law that is outdated, but you find it in the Patriot Act, and now you find it in this recent NDAA law. So legislators have to go back and surgically remove all these things when we have the ability, and that's when we have the power, when we take control of the committees. And we can't allow these kinds of things to remain on the books. And we have to really fight very hard and educate people how dangerous this is. Detaining people indefinitely, the lack of heavy, that goes contrary to the Constitution. It's basic. I'm not a constitutional attorney, but I have some common sense, and this is really contrary to what it is that I believe is something we took an oath to uphold, and that's the Constitution, not the government.
People would rather feel safe than be free. And this is very troubling because I think in this particular situation, it affects certain communities more than others. And human beings, by very nature, are selfish, so it's like out of sight, out of mind. Well, it doesn't affect me, my family, my citizens, people who look like me. It will keep us safe. That's okay. And specifically in the Arab American, Middle Eastern, Muslim American communities, that specific language that Congressman Honda pointed to, it gives us tremendous pause. And it should give actually all U.S. citizens pause, because it says that the president has the authority to detain all U.S. citizens. So it's not just a particular type of U.S. citizen who looks a certain way, all U.S. citizens. I think President Obama said that, I am displeased with this language, and I promise not to enforce it. Well, why'd you have it in the bill in the first place? Which is that. Number two, I landed, and in the morning, I read the Supreme Court decision that came in the New York Times, and it was really quite chilling. If I read it properly, it means that it allows police officers to strip search for all arrests. So it gives the police the authority to conduct strip searches for all arrests without any reasonable suspicion or without any arrest that is pertaining to alcohol or drugs. And that's primarily the main reason why they did strip searches, because people used to hide drugs in certain places. So they said for all arrests, if the police deem it necessary, they can strip search. And I think this is troubling. It was a split decision, 5-4. And I think, again, reflects the fissures in our country right now. I think Justice Kennedy was one of the fifth vote that tilted it. Troubling decision, misguided decision. And I think I fear for this decision, because the people who are the victims of strip searches, which are humiliating, by the way, are people from the African American and Latino community. And there's already a tremendous trust deficit in those particular communities when it comes to those communities and law enforcement. So you can just imagine now police who have authorized from the Supreme Court to do blanket strip searches whenever they want to. The people, statistically, who will suffer from this indignity the most are people from those communities. And just to talk about real quick what we're suffering from right now, what we see is this cauldron that I hope gets simmered. You know, the Trayvon Martin case, you know, also reflects these deep fissures that we have in society where members from a certain community are saying, listen, our experience with law enforcement is quite different from others. And it's a reflection of a certain type of inequality. It's a reflection of powerlessness. It's a reflection that some people are feeling victimized. And I think specifically, if this law is practiced the way it will be by police officers, I fear that will increase the divisions, especially along economic lines and especially along racial lines. And it's a really troubling decision.
The kinds of things that we can do, though, is on a local level not to accept that kind of a decision. There was laws that passed that allowed police officers locally to become immigration personnel. And the city of San Jose, the police chief there says, we are not engaging in what they call secure communities where local law enforcement would have through a agreement with ICE that they can stop and detain people as if they were federal immigration officers. The other phrase that is similar to yours is, I think it was Benjamin Franklin that said, those who are willing to give up a little bit of liberty for a little bit of security deserves neither. And so, you know, local action can start to create the contradiction of what we do at the federal level. And when local action starts to take hold, then people start to create that dialogue and start to ask themselves, is this what we're all about? And so the debate starts at the city council, school boards, county board of supervisors, and this is where I think the groundswell of public opinion starts to turn political wills around. And I think that's the value of this kind of a dialogue and this kind of a forum.
And we see these things. We talk about history repeating itself. Trayvon Martin, go back to someone like Wen Ho Lee, not so many years ago. I mean, we see these kinds of things. In those respects, only the players change. The concepts remain the same, and which leads one to wonder whether we really are moving along. And you see this kind of decisions coming back from the Supreme Court. And for that matter, when you see even the Obama administration, I think disappointing quite a few civil libertarians with which they would call overreaching in terms of using the fear of terrorism to use racial profiling and other types of things. So I think in some respects, you know, as much as we talk about moving ahead, we may not be moving ahead as much as we're trying to drag people with us to move ahead. Here's one. We've identified contributions of politics, race, media, and others to prejudice and I can't read this one. We'll leave it as prejudice. An exclusive behavior, I think it's called. That's not quite
exclusion.
It. Exclusion behavior, thank you. How about religions? To what extent do religions, I think this is what it's asking, to what extent do religions bring harm or at least foment prejudice by their own teachings? Oof. Who wants to take that one?
As a Christian, I will. I mean, you know, history is replete with conflicts between religions. You know, the Crusades is a good example. Religious persecution. People came to this country to have religious freedom, and they had it within Christianity. But beyond that, you know, they started to have differences of opinions, and there again, you know, who's going to have sway in the community? Who's going to have the power? I've always thought, as a young man growing up, that this country always stereotyped or created fear or dehumanized people based upon religious rationale, sex, or color, or the combination of it. You know, Asians are the yellow people, they're the yellow devils, they're pagans, and they could never be Christians. You could never have them close to your daughter. And so it's using all those kinds of things in terms of fear. pastors, leaders, religious leaders will pick that up and, you know, proselytize against the folks and forgetting the very teachings that we're supposed to understand in our own religions. And I don't think there's a major religion in this world that preaches hate. It always seems to me that they preach oneness, spirituality, compassion, all the things that my mother tried to instill in me, and yet, even in my own church, my church is going to hate me now. You know, they talk about there's a great fear of there's a homophobia in my congregation that's carried on by the leadership, and I tell them this is not right. I can't agree with you, and and every turn I have, I try to bring this up and sort of explain these things, but they always go to the Bible, or the Greek translations that I don't understand to sustain their position. And people using religion to sustain a position is unconscionable. But religion is a powerful tool to move people in one direction.
Religions don't speak; its adherents do. So I've never heard Islam speak, but Muslims speak. I've never had dinner with Islam, and I'm sure if it did, it probably wouldn't pay for the bill. Hopefully it would. Hopefully it would. I'm allowed to. I'm Muslim. I can make fun of my own people. We're talking again about the human condition here, I think. And I think it's very easy for some to say religion is the cause of all evil, or to say without religion, you are evil, right? And again, religion doesn't speak. Its adherents do. And specifically about Islam, I said, Islam doesn't speak, Muslims do. Well, I just want to give a quick example of two Muslims, quote-unquote Muslims. One Muslim is the best-selling poet in America today, who wrote poetry 800 years ago, and whose poetry outsells Frost and Dickinson, whose poetry actually illuminates hearts, heals hearts, helps people get dates, and is probably one of your Facebook quote. The name is Rumi, who was as Muslim can be. In fact, a Muslim jurist and scholar who became a poet later in his life. And it was due to his love for the divine, his love for Islam, really, that inspired this love for humanity. Another Muslim that a lot of people know is this guy called Osama bin Laden, right?
Heard of him.
Who, despite being any form of a scholar, believed he was committing legitimate, quote-unquote, jihad, all right? And in his war against, I would say, civilians. Not a religious scholar, but claimed the language of religion to validate his perverse criminal actions. Mm-hmm. And specifically, talking about, again, Islam doesn't speak, Muslims do, there was something called the Amman Conference in Jordan a few years ago, where traditional religious Muslim scholars using traditional Islam pretty much came up with this document, a very powerful document, where using traditional Islam, they used Islamic law and Islam and said that you cannot justify terrorism or violence against civilians using Islam, Quran, the Hadith, and Islamic scholarship. So again, we see Muslims speaking, right, using this language of religion. Osama claimed he was Muslim. Rumi was a Muslim. The Amman Conference had Muslim scholars. I met Muslims in Pakistan who hate other Muslims just because one's Sunni and one's Shia. And then again, I met Muslims in Pakistan who spend their whole lives helping bridge this rift and feed the homeless. And when you ask them why, they say, I'm doing it for my religion. Okay. So it's not just religion. I just want to make this point. There's also other isms that have inspired hatred, division, wars. Stalinism, Nazism, fascism, nationalism, capitalism, communism. And I think Congressman Honda made a really good point. As a Muslim, as a person, adherent of a religion, there needs to be an audit of our leaders, and there needs to be an audit, I think, sometimes of the congregation itself. And I say this as a citizen of America also. There needs to be an audit and a check on some of the rhetoric and views that are left unchecked. And I've seen that when people speak up, and when people speak up in mass, then usually what I've seen is people generally have goodwill, but there's usually always a few very vocal, very organized, very extremist people who dominate the discourse. especially I could speak from a religious congregation, and everyone else just kind of shushes up, right? And I think it takes an audit by a community of its leadership, if the leadership has failed, to help steer it towards a moderate discourse that is in line with the religious principles that I believe, as a person who is a Muslim American, I think religion can be a force of tremendous good, of tremendous hope. Martin Luther King spoke from a religious tradition. Gandhi spoke from a religious tradition. Malcolm X spoke from a religious tradition. Right? Mother Teresa spoke from a religious tradition. And I think, again, we, for those of you who belong to a religious tradition, we have a tremendous wealth, a spiritual wealth of good values and good role models and good prophets and good stories that we can implement in the 21st century.
Our time is short, and in fact, we've used it up. And I apologize to those of you who've sent in questions that we couldn't get to. Perhaps these gentlemen will stick around for a few minutes and chat with you. But our thanks to the panel for coming. Our thanks to you for coming.
Thank you. And,
thank you.
I too hope you all enjoyed this evening's program, and we look forward to seeing you at future Silicon Valley Reads events. Personally, I can say to you, I've read both of the books that have been selected this year, and they were eye-opening to me. I heard a theme of education, and as someone who's been in education or was for 42-plus years, I particularly enjoyed The Muslim Next Door, learned a lot about Islam that I didn't know, and that's the purpose, and that's the purpose of tonight, is to educate ourselves and to be aware of where we're coming from as we approach different areas. Again, we would like to thank our panelists, Wajahat Ali. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Congressman Mike Honda. And Dr. Larry Gersten, and all of you for joining us. And good night from the Commonwealth Club. Thank you very much.